A very warm welcome to you, Cynthia, to the online Congress Change with Spirit 2022. We are very happy to have you connected to an issue where you have a lot of experience to share. Hello.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And again, I salute you for the nobility of what you're attempting to collect here. Let's see if we can make it work.
I'm sure we do. Cynthia, you are connected from the United States. We have 6 hours of difference in time. You are a modern day mystic. You are an Episcopal priest. You are a collaborator of Richard Rohr in the Center of Action and Contemplation, and a very requested retreat leader, and writer of several books translated even in German. We will consider one in our interview. We are leading, and this book, I have read it 3 times, The Holy Trinity and the Law of Three. Simon has read it as well. We are leading the interview together. Simon is son of a last year's Congress participant and collaborator, Cornelia Zuck. Simon knows the English language much better than me, so he will put the questions and take the lead in the interview. Thank you very much, Simon.
Of course.
And Simon is much younger than me, could be my son. So he will connect us to the generation which is inheriting the consequences of our very dualistic approach, heavily afflicting the whole planet and humanity. So Simon, go on and lead the interview.
Thank you. Sure. Hello and good morning, everyone. Good morning, Egbert. Good morning, Cynthia. Really, really pleased to be here and to lead us through this interview today. Egbert already held up the book in German. So this is the English version. I hope you can see it a little bit far off here. Yeah. So this is the book in English. It's called The Holy Trinity and the Law of Three. And we have read your book, The Holy Trinity and the Law of Three, and watched several of your YouTube videos and lectures and interviews. And we were really fascinated by your fresh, unconventional access to ancient sources of spiritual texts and traditions, and really open up a new perspective for our time. Because our current presence is really afflicted by enormous global challenges, which can only be solved through collaboration across cultures, religions, philosophies, and worldviews. And I'd like to start this interview, respectively, this conversation. It's not an interview, it's a conversation, right? With some personal questions. And the first one being, where and perhaps when in your life have you started to experience your individuality and deep connectedness at the same time? Could you expand on that, perhaps, to get our audience more of a flair in the sense of who you are and how you came into this trajectory here?
Well, as it so happens in my life, it happened in a very striking moment that I can actually occur most vividly. I think for most people, it's typical that these things grow gradually so that you can never really remember a time when you didn't have it. But for me, it entered. And it entered dramatically. And I think I must have been 3.5 years old, because I remember I was standing in a field that was filled with pumpkins, which would make it around October, you know. And of course, in the United States, Halloween is a great holiday and everybody harvests their pumpkins for Halloween. So I was walking in this field near our country home as a little tot. And all of a sudden, I just looked at the orange of these pumpkins in the pumpkin fields, and this sense descended, I am here. And it was an extraordinary sense. And certainly the most powerful characteristic of that was the sense of me-ness, the sense of individuality. But what was carrying the whole thing was this deeper connectedness, which is still sort of deeply in the color orange of the pumpkins and the vividness of the whole scene, and you could essentially see the energy jumping throughout the whole picture. So it wasn't a kind of Camusian or Sartre, I am here and the rest of the world is absurd. I woke up as an individuated pixel within a vibrant whole.
This is striking that you can remember that when you were 3.5 years old. Most people can't. So
it wow. is. I mean, it was like a thunderclap, which was it was almost like somebody calling you by your name and you're off and running. And as I said, I don't think it typically happens this way to people, but it is one of the probably top 10 vivid life impressions in my life. Certainly the earliest one.
Okay, very good. Thank you for sharing this very personal insight with us, Cynthia. I really appreciate this. And I think this whole experience did carry on throughout your life. And I think that begs the next question for me is, what is really the unifying in the world that connects us beyond cultures, religions, philosophies, and worldviews? And could you elaborate on this one?
Well, I would have to connect it simply as a flow. And as a flow, which comes from what I would language from my own kind of Christian reference points, as the will of God to manifest in form. And it's a mysterious will, but it flings itself out from this inscrutable mystery that doesn't seem to prefer the state of being locked up in itself. That seems to prefer, as the Sufis say about God, when asked, why did God create? God responds, I was a hidden treasure and I love to be known. So I created the worlds manifest and unmanifest. And it's this yearning for intimacy, for knowing and being known, which I find is the fundamental connecting being energy that flows through the world, creating the sort of paradoxical conditions in which knowing and being known can happen, which means that you have to have conscious reflection. You have to have a perceiver and a perceived. You have to have separation for there to be unity. And I think that folks have never really been able to wrap their minds around the implications of this. It's like unity is often seen in a kind of trivial way as the erasing of separation. You know, if we could all just love each other, if we could all just be the same. But then you would be right back into the same undifferentiated, unknowable God with this still unsatisfied urge to manifest. To manifest, to be reflected, requires a principle of harmonized separateness that I think that we need to keep an eye on.
Thank you, Cynthia. These are beautiful words. I'd say, Let's shift gears a little bit. Is there something else you would say from your personal life before we dive right into the matter of the book, before we continue? Is there anything else you would like to pass on to our audience?
I think it would be better if it simply comes out in the course of the interview.
Sure, no problem. Okay, let's then shift gears and come to the concept of Trinity and the law of faith. And you're right, and I quote you here from the book. It says, Karl Rahner has claimed that if the Trinity were quietly disappear out of Christian theology, never to be mentioned again, most of Christendom would not even notice its absence. And I was wondering, what's the case you'd make to convince our listeners that the Trinity did not lose any relevancy whatsoever, and perhaps we need it even more than ever before, especially given these parallel times that we're living?
Yep. Well, that's actually wound up being one of the major thrusts of my life work. I think one of the reasons that the Trinity is so manifestly irrelevant to most Christians and is looked on with suspicion by the rest of the world is because it's usually immediately anthropomorphized. It's about three persons called Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then people start fighting with those anthropomorphized visions, and women complain that there's not enough female representation in this, and they try and language it in female. But it's still basically working with a much too anthropomorphized and concrete sense of personhood. What I learned way back in the days when I was emerged, when I was introduced to the Gurdjieff work in the 1980s, was the pre-existence of threeness as a principle of world creation. In other words, of bringing things into existence so that they could deal with exactly this paradox I talked about earlier. The need for both separation and unity in dynamic equilibrium so that there can be creation at all. And Gurdjieff had seen, and how he had ever learned this, people still don't know, but when he came back from a 20-year search in Central Asia and the other great wisdom strongholds of the world, he came back unfolding this law, which is so different from anything that that has ever had ever been raised and pictured theologically. So it says that these three persons that we like to think of them as are actually, if my line of argument is right, are representations, are personifications of these three primordial principles that interweave to create form out of non-form and non-form out of form, and always moving it dynamically forward. And to the extent that we work with it that way, we've solved a couple of big theological problems. First of all, we solved the problem with the rest of the world, which is, you know, which will either tend to say, well, three gods sounds like tritheism, and or the my good Hindu friends will say, why only three? You know, and so the rest of the world just scratches their head, and most of the Western Hebraic tradition just says, well, they've just gone crazy with polytheism. But when you see that what it really is a way of picturing, a kind of poetic and very, very feelingful way, moral way of depicting fundamental laws that allow somethingness to come into being out of nothingness, to that extent, it universalizes it, allows it to be recaptured in other domains of human experience too, to be validated in science, to be validated in psychology, to be validated in politics. And so it doesn't just become a kind of talisman of a certain kind of theological devotion. So that's been my principle, that there are very, very strong corroborations of this in science, in social sciences. People keep bumping into it as a scientific principle without any idea at all that it's a metaphysical principle, because Christianity doesn't know that either. You know, but to derive everything in heaven and earth from three persons of undetermined gender, and it's just too narrow, way too narrow for our world today.
We will go to this topic of personhood in just a second. Before we do that, let's choose the historic backdrop. You were alluding already to Gurdjieff, yeah. If I'm not mistaken. Could you unpack for us the historic development of your thought on which you build the case that the Trinity itself is not a static being, but is rather, let's say, converging, three out of three come a fourth one. Could you help for our audience to understand? This is not a very new concept that has been created throughout the last 10 years or so, but it has a rather much more elaborate historic background that most people don't know of. Could you expand on that?
Yeah, well, first of all, just so that people who may not have read the book in either English or German have some idea what we're talking about with the law of three. It states that for any new creation, for anything to come into existence at all, this is the result of three interwoven but independent forces, which Gurdjieff called affirming, denying, and reconciling. Affirming is the pushing principle, the thing that initiates the action. Denying is either that which pushes back or the medium through which the pushing thing has to flow. And the reconciling is what allows them to come into relationship without just gridlocking, without just becoming polarized forces. So it's a very important and subtle force. So a lot of people say, well, that just sounds like Hegel. It sounds like thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. But there is a crucial distinction because in Hegel, you have just the two of them pushing against each other, and out of that comes synthesis. The law of three says it's synthesis, thesis, antithesis plus X equals synthesis. So the synthesis is the fourth, and until this X factor enters, you have only impasse, you have dualization, you have polarization, you have nothing new. So that's the major difference. And you may think it's subtle, but it's world-changing, because I would say that that as we look at our world today, a Gurdjieffian would say immediately that, well, you know, the problem is we're lacking third force. We're just banging back and forth between the opposites, you know, goodness, badness, this world, red, blue in our country, you know, that we don't seem to be able to get out of the polarizations. And even the movement that calls itself non-dual tends to be equally affected by polarizations, because there's still the preferred outcome and the unpreferred outcome. There's harmony, unity, and then there's dissipation, chaos, and you still set up this kind of oppositional dialectical structure without really getting any kind of harmony other than judgment. So to get back to the historical piece, Gurdjieff is being very, very much re-acknowledged and reappropriated nowadays. When he first entered the scene of history, it was in the early 20th century, about 100 years ago, almost to the decades. And he was an Armenian-born spiritual seeker of Christian Greek Orthodox upbringing, who became convinced early on that there was a deeper meaning, integrity, and coherence to life, a deeper wisdom that people had once known but had now forgotten. And that the traces of this wisdom that would sort of put the whole puzzle together and allow people to see what their obligations were and what their real possibilities were, that existed. But we had our little roadmaps, particularly in the West, were so fragmented that nobody could put all the pieces together. It was just like Hegel. You've almost got it, but you only got two pieces of it. The third is missing. So he went searching with a few like-minded people, on a search that took him for more than 20 years in the last part of the 19th and early 20th century, into the great wisdom kingdoms in Egypt, Central Asia, Tibet, in the Caucasus Mountains, where he did manage to encounter bits and pieces of old schools still passing on these traditions. And from these, he came back into the West on the eve of World War I, bringing this tradition. And one of the things that he brought, he was officially the first one to reintroduce the Enneagram to the West. And the map of the Enneagram, as we now know it, hung as a symbol in his study house in his Paris headquarters in the 20s. But the Enneagram is a visual depiction of the law of three. That's the triangle in the inside, and the law of seven, which is about process once things get into form, which is those funny little grasshopper legs around the way. So he was teaching people in the 20s how to process the world according to the law of three, and to create meaningful change, both in their own being and in their own world, through the skillful application of this space, which in his teaching was mostly third force is typically occupied by conscious attention and presence. I'm not saying they're the same thing, but the fact is that if you're present, if you're mindful, if you're there, if you're not completely lost in your issue, you're much more likely to see where the real holy, the reconciling can come. So he taught it. He was mostly during his days dismissed as an esoteric cultist, a magician, a con man. You know, the polite society was not at all invested in acknowledging him. And since he was not authorized, particularly by any religious tradition, it was easy to just sort of corral him. And so he's lived in kind of spiritual and academic isolation for 50, 60 years. His lineage mostly kept alive by some very small, dedicated, and largely reclusive groups. I won't say secretive, but they don't let themselves be known easily. So, but nowadays there's a whole resurgence as more and more as science and the social sciences are independently discovering what he discovered, and as the whole Enneagram of personality movement just took off worldwide, giving people an immediate practical access point to seeing how this actually belongs to an ancient tradition. That people are coming back for a second look, because we're beginning to see more and more that we have been really trapped within the very narrow mental confines of a structure of consciousness that defines Western civilization and dominates all our thinking categories and patterns. And that seems to be coming to an end and taking the institutions that have ridden on its back down with them. So in this great period of disorientation and collective remorse, people are looking again at some of these truths that only 50 years ago they saw fit to poo-poo and to say were not intellectually credible.
I'm wondering, you mentioned the resurgence in interest in these, I wouldn't say ancient, but let's say historically recent discoveries of Gurdjieff. And you have mentioned that this is being backed up by scientific discoveries, so that it's not only the mythicals and philosophers and Christians discovering this piece, but it's also scientists and researchers. Could you give us an overview, respectively, let's say a scientific backing of the discovery that you and others in your field have made that gives, let's say, more scientific credibility to those who, let's say, from the devil's advocate perspective, say this is all nonsense? Could you elaborate on this?
Well, my poster child for this, and I certainly hope it's okay with him because I haven't had a personal conversation, but my poster child, you know, over the years, people keep coming in with books from largely social scientists from Harvard and other places like that. This says, this sounds like the law of three. But the guy who just discovered it almost verbatim recently is a fellow by the name of Adrian Bejan, who's a professor of engineering at I believe at Duke University, who back in the early 21st century, in a book in 2012 called Design in Nature, revealed what he called the constructal law, which is an absolute carbon copy of the law of three. He says that in order for any finite flow system to persist in time, and a finite flow system is something that something flows through. It could be your lungs that breath flows through. It could be a riverbed. It could be an airplane terminal. It could be the World Wide Web. But if something whose purpose is to is to conduct something that flows through it, if that is to survive, he says, it has to arrange itself to grant the maximum access to the currents that flow through it. So this is an absolute textbook law of three. The flow system is the affirming principle, the thing trying to flow through. The system is the denying principle, you know, the river valley or the tree root or whatever, whatever it has to make its way through. And the algorithm that allows them to meet is the algorithm of maximize access. So with that as the principle that everybody's playing with, you get this remarkably beautiful pattern that he points out is replicated in river valleys and human lungs and tree roots. They're all carved out of the same application of the law of three. And this guy is emphatically secular and agnostic, has no time whatever, and lets you know in a few paragraphs his opinions on religion. But he still discovered essentially what the law of three is really saying. And I could list many other applications in sciences, social sciences, and biology, but I think that will do enough to at least give you some clue as to what I'm talking about. The other thing that makes it very interesting is that it's empirically validatable. And one of the things that we've often done in our wisdom groups is to ask our students to work with the law of three and see how they can apply it in their own lives. So they start playing with it. One of my favorite stories was a woman who used it to successfully diet to lose 10 pounds, which had betrayed her and defied her all her life. But she finally figured out that she had affirming and denying forces missing, backwards. And when she got them correctly, she could see what needed to be brought in. It couldn't be just this kind of bloody willpower that never got her anywhere, but it was something else. And it shifted the picture. And she not only managed to lose the weight she wanted to lose, but developed a whole new relationship with food and with cooking.
That's great. So yeah, let's shift gears a bit back to the Trinity itself. And you have come to the conclusion that the Trinity is about process rather than persons. It's primarily about how God moves and flows, how God changes from one form, respectively a state, into another within the domain of manifestation and interpenetrates, if you will, the immutability of creation within the wholeness of divine being. And since this is basically the topic of this whole workshop here is the paradigm of binary systems. So that's to say they function on the principle of paired opposites. So for instance, a good example is male, female, light and darkness, yin and yang, whatever you may call it. And could you unpack for us the differences between them and why you argue that the Trinity is not binary, and on contrarily, it's rather ternary?
Yeah. And there's another point that I hope you'll angle back to that I just don't want to lose track of here. But I want to say that that having said that the Trinity doesn't arise in the personal, it's not all about three persons. I would also say that the personal contains the missing piece in all of this. And I do want to talk about that sometime before this conversation is over. So it's not a mistake that we have Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or however you want to language them. But for now, it's a habit of the mind that we mostly use nowadays that Western culture is essentially founded on, the mental structure of consciousness. It's a habit of it to set things up in paired opposites that become very quickly dialectics. You know, they become either ors. It's a really good shorthand for thinking. It has a lot of forward motion to it. But at very least, paired opposites certainly arise in what you might call more primordial structures of consciousness in the mythical, but they're seen as polarities. As and as interweaving or alternatively manifesting aspects of a unified wholeness. And we've lost that. I'm teaching a course right now on the mystery of death, and a lot of people are, you know, it's hard for us to see that our death is already in our life, because death seems like that which is opposed to life, because we've lost a sense of the polarity. And it's the polarity, it's the rhythmic movement between what look like polar opposites that actually creates the reconciling principle that keeps it from falling into dialectic duality. And it's this part that we seem to have most lost, because when we lose it, when we lose polarity, when we lose, which is where space-time plays in, where temporicity plays in, how long it takes to get from one thing to another, process plays in. When we lose all those sort of things, we collapse the possibility of what the created unity really looks like. We collapse it back into, it's a single oneness. It becomes in some sense a regression to the single white light that can never, that doesn't quite know how to deal with diversity and fragments and bits, because they seem to disrupt this very simplistic notion of unity. Teilhard de Chardin was one of the first people onto this, where he talked about the unity that really was being celebrated in the fullness of love, in the fullness of Christian mystical faith, was a single monad, but was he called it a paroxysm of harmonized complexity. It's a very difficult word, and I'm the English translation of what he originally said in French to a mainly German-speaking audience, so go figure. But he had this powerful notion that he substantiated as an evolutionary scientist, that unity was not about singleness, sameness, or collapsing of differentiation with all the anguish that it causes, but was about something that would flow through the space created in this complexity to harmonize the whole without canceling out the parts. And I think that's the part of it that is so profoundly alluded to in the Law of Three, and is characteristic of a Western non-dual mysticism, but we mostly don't see that yet, because most of the models and even the really good people that are thinking about this and writing about it are writing it, out of the Western philosophical tradition, which is, sort of, I think, irredeemably dualistic in its basic thought patterns.
Since you have to take our audience along our conversation and not lose them, I think it's conducive to make them fully understand the Law of Three and the three foundational principles that you have laid out in your book. I might read them out here. And the first one is the following, that in every new arising, there are three forces involved. You already alluded to them. It's affirming, denying, and reconciliation or reconciling. The second part being the interweaving of these three, of affirming, denying, and reconciliation, produce a fourth in a new dimension. And the third and last piece is affirming, denying, and reconciling are not fixed points or permanent essence attributes, but can and do shift and must be discerned situationally. In one of your lectures on YouTube, I don't know where exactly I found it, you used two beautiful examples, one being the seat and one sailing. And could you help our audience understand from, let's say, a practical perspective, how we should understand them in terms for the example of the seat and the sailing boat? Because I think that gives our audience, let's say, a good grasp of how this practically is being applied.
Well, the sailing boat is the easiest one because it's there. The terms are straightforward. The that when I was in school, when I was learning science in elementary school, I was always taught that a sailboat goes through the water by the opposing pressures of the wind in its sails and the water on its keels. But when I actually got my first sailboat, I learned this wasn't quite true, that a sailboat in that position doesn't move through the water. It rounds up into the wind and comes to a dead stop. And in order for you to actually make progress toward where you're going, you need that third element, which is the helmsman, myself, with my hand on the tiller, setting the course and deciding where to put the sail and how close to the wind to sail. It's that element that takes what is otherwise just a stonewall gridlock and turns it into a new arising, which is the sailboat moving toward the water to its destination. So that's what I'm talking about in that exercise. The seed is a little bit more complicated because you have to figure out how you're going to slice the deck. You've got the seed, and then you've got the which is fairly quickly the affirming force. It's got the force. You've got whatever the ground is that you put it in, and just for fun, let's say that you're putting it in the earth. I know that a lot of seeds can be started by putting them in water, but let's say you're putting it in the earth. So that's the denying force. That's the thing it's going to have to push through. And for the reconciling, for the thing that actually allows these two to come into action and to begin to manifest, you need this combination that comes from water and sun. You know, you need the light. You need the nourishment that actually quickens it. So you've got those elements contribute the reconciling principle, which allows seed with its incipient force and ground with its containing and resisting force to come into a relationship out of which emerges a plant. So these are sort of simple examples of how the thing looks. And a lot of people say, well, that's obvious. And that's just the point. And it's both a saving point and a damning point, because third force is almost always right under our nose. It is obvious, but until we're in a certain way of looking at things, we don't see it. And everything in the way our brain has been set up and cultivated, both its organic sort of rut tracks and the way we work with it in our culture, are intended, you know, have powerful effect of making us third force blind.
And
Yeah.
You wanted to say something.
Yeah, no, that's and it's the and when we're third force blind, there's going to be nothing more than just gridlock. People in their positions, people in their attitudes, people getting more and more angry and dismayed at each other and judgmental because they're not seeing the reconciling force that's the underlying flow in everything.
We'll come to this part of how we can cultivate this affinity to unearth the law of free in our personal lives. We will come to that at a later stage. So please keep that as a thought for the time being. I would slightly shift gears and bring up a topic that is on our heart and our minds, especially for these Europeans on a daily basis. And it's the war in Ukraine. So Cynthia, in your book, you write that the law of free is intended first and foremost as a practical tool for solving interpersonal problems affecting political outcomes. And it is particularly brilliant in situations that appear to be at an impasse. So my question would be, if we look at the impasse of the war in the Ukraine, how would you apply you, Cynthia Bourgeot, the law of free in your dynamic concept that you elaborate in your book of the Holy Trinity to this very specific situation. And I'm sure everyone knows much about what is going on at the moment, but could you help us identify how we should think about it?
Well, we have to add one more piece in, which is that we do receive cosmic assistance. That one of the things that's tended to make us so anxious and vigilant and over meddling sometimes in our world is that we doubt the fact that there's anything else out in the cosmos that really gives a damn about this planet. It's all up to us. And so we react with our urgency and our moral outrage without realizing that much of the force that certainly there are higher intelligences and higher powers than ourselves, for whom this planet and the functions it performs in the greater cosmic harmony are sacred and important. And so in funny ways, when we can step back from our own tendency towards sentimentality and look at things with brutal honesty and a kind of impartial honesty, which you kind of have to do, you realize that wars come and go, that human atrocity comes and goes, that this disruption, you know, this Molotov cocktail we've gotten of the COVID, the global warming, and this regressive upheaval in the Ukraine, are all signs of this deeper cosmic disturbance as an era of consciousness goes down in flames and another one struggles to be born. And it requires a kind of what might look like even as a heartless impartiality to regard things with enough lucidity that you just don't get jerked completely all around the planet with sentimentality and with outrage. How do we work? How do we look at things like the massacres and the rapes and the savage betrayal of what the face of humanity looks like without just reacting in outrage? But what's really required on the personal level is to deeply maintain a space of impartiality, a space where we don't get jerked by reactivity, and a deep sense that if one can hold a space in which the face of humanity is being individually mirrored in my own face, in my own eyes, then there is perhaps a way that we can become collectively third force amenable. As each one of us individually does our work, which is not that we don't care, but that we bring this caring to a higher place of impartiality and trust and hold that space of non-reactivity and non-identification, then it's possible that amazing things work through it. And I think that we're actually seeing extraordinary life, and I pray to God I'm not being sentimental here, but the Ukraine has been an Easter to us this year. And this stream of human courage, of human resurrection, of human solidarity, and in the beautiful face of these two young people, these entertainers who are now leading this country with something that resembles human courage and human morality. Where did that come from? somebody pasted a story, you know, on my Facebook stream the other day of this Polish baker who's just taken off to the fronts there with his baking oven because he's going to give bread. And I think that what's been happening collectively is that something has finally touched a nerve of what does it mean to be a human being? How do we not desecrate? And it relativizes the the face of these monsters. And you know, our country has produced its share of them too. It got the whole thing started. But we're weathering a cosmic passage. And the only thing that's going to carry us through it is our collective ability to maintain a high enough benchmark of what it means to be a human being that we can actually reach out and create a bridge with the help coming to us, because this place is precious and it is the evolving heart of God. So that would be my sense. I see third force happening all over the place in Ukraine. The only reason I read the news is because I know there's always going to be something surprising that shows up there. And you know, if the planet is not involved, and if the powers are not involved in this kind of, it's become the paschal lamb for the cleansing of the human conscience. And in that sense, it's not a happy solution, like let's all get together and, you know, stomp out the Russians, but the Russians are tormented here too. It's like we're in the grip of madness. And the only way you can really speak to madness is to not allow yourself to go mad. And as we bring that Christic grace, something will come of it.
Santia, you're already trying to help us to make a practical step to let's say, understand how we should apply the third force in our lives, because we are wired to thinking in and or versus both and, right? So you're saying, or you are essentially saying, that third force is best accessed through an alert, flexible presence, which is not gravitating to either side, and then it can hold the tensions of the opposites together. And what does not work, and I'm sure that this is a collective agreement, that judgment and rigorous adherence to a desired expectation or to an outcome. So to make it practical to our audience again, how can we unearth this, let's say, finally developed sense of both and instead of this either or? Because now our audience might be puzzled, okay, we might have the sense of non-partiality, which sounds cold and sobering, but how can we, let's say, remain sensitive to this topic, but also take ourselves back from it without taking it too personal?
Well, what we're really talking about is a different level of being. A lot of people think that non-duality is just paradox tolerance, you know, being able to see both ends of the situation. But the fact is that the mind and the ego can't do this. And I'm not saying that judgmentally in a sense of bad, bad ego, but in the sense that the structure of our conscious perception is such that it's always going to split it that way. And we get to see both sides, but in the end, we're finally going to have one we like better. You know, we're not going to be able to hold, I've just proved I'm non-dual because I've listened to their position, but now I'm going to tell you mine. That's not non-dual. That's the mental simulacrum of it. What really happens is that you have to develop the next level of self, the next being beyond your ego selfhood, you know. And it's very interesting. You started this whole interview with the question of how, when was I first aware of myself, you know? And this self is both a blessing and a curse all your life. But as you grow older, it begins to become more and more diaphanous. more and more transparent. And you realize there's a different kind of self running an entirely different program of perception that doesn't judge, that doesn't stand outside of things and evaluate them and decide who's the good guys and who's the bad guys, that can stand in the midst of the flow and receive the energies of reconciliation at a higher level of being. But really the capacity to access and live in non-dual consciousness, I think, belongs to and is interreliably only as we develop a stable sense of ourself in witnessing presence, not egoic selfhood. Mm-hmm. The next notch deeper. And witnessing presence is not held in the mind. It's held in the heart, the solar plexus, the torso area. It's a whole rewiring of the subtle energetic system of the being. And as your being increases, you can stay present to paradox without judging. You can stay present to occupancy. But the moment you get sucked into the story of the self, it's like something is draining your battery. Because our sense of who am I, what do I feel about things, where am I going, how do I react to that, is a huge energy drain, which drags the energy of our being and conscious perception down below a level in which we can actually see and be helpful. So the mystics have been talking about this all along, but not in any language that people can understand. But it's, for me, it's very simple. And I keep coming back to the standard refrain that it begins paradoxically with a rigorous adherence to whatever personal discipline of meditation you want to use. My own is centering prayer, but there are other forms. But what this will do in whatever method you work with it in is that it will begin to shift you out of your automatic association of yourself with your mind. You know, you can't really see your eyes because you're looking at them all the time. But as you develop a meditation practice, you begin to see your own eyes. You begin to see the structures of consciousness, not just the content of consciousness. It's defining your thought and defining your reactivity to things and generating your sense of value in the first place. And once you begin to see that as a system that you can step beyond and encompass in something else, then you're more open to receiving and trusting this deeper sense of selfhood, which is being given to you both individually and collectively, because this is the threshold our planet is hovering on. And people stuck in their individual consciousness and their ego consciousness and their values and their over-identifications and their concerns and their urgencies aren't going to solve anything. Because help doesn't come at that level. It just increases the decibels of the polarization. So it's the beginning in that place of inner exploration, of inner openness. And then the part that I got from Gurdjieff that I find has become increasingly helpful, and he's almost alone amongst the teachers in his emphasis on this, is the capacity to pay attention, to not just use meditation to, in any sense, zone out or get away from your ego self, but to learn how to pay very meticulous attention to the structures, the beings, the subtle energy currents that actually flow through your outer body, to wield attention, to see, and to allow your whole being to become a responsive vessel of understanding. And he's created a whole set of exercises and practices that really, really tune you out so that you realize that your outer body is not neutral or not just something you need to go away with, but is an underutilized vehicle for the reception of a spiritual information and assistance. And as those two practices are gained, we find that we naturally flow into relationship with others doing the same thing. Because one of the laws at that next level is, of course, the non-localized action. And we make a mess of that when we try and do it with our middle brains, but when we do it in this other place, you see, it's obvious that nothing can go into the planet without affecting everything else.
It's like the butterfly that flaps with its wings and it causes a storm on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, and I mean, you can sentimentalize those things, but it's still very, very true. So, but you begin to work in that lighter atmosphere. And in there, you begin a different line of causality opens to you, a law of three line of causality, and not this linear task-oriented cause and effect, time sequence causality that we're used to dealing with in this world.
I think that speaks to me and my generation that I'm speaking on behalf of, that this generation that I'm of is Gen Z's or Gen X or how whatever you might define it, is aware of the consequences that they are, whatever action they are conducting, whatever happens to their lives that has a consequence on someone else, whether that's on the planet, whether it's on people, whether it's on situations, whether it's for short term, whether it's for the long term. And I have the gut feeling, I mean, it's a gut feeling, it's a personal observation, that there is this generation that I'm in is less dualistic and is more aware of the complexity of this world and of our being itself, versus it's like sometimes feeling like we were standing in a ditch and we were pulled with both sides of our arms trying to, you know, fall onto either side. But I think the generation that I'm in is more aware of this. Do you have the same perception? Do you think that this is also a generational matter before things get more improved over time? Or is that, would you say that the generational gap is rather something that is obnoxious and can human beings are rather capable of fulfilling, let's say, their own improvement over time, versus the effects that the outer world has on them?
Well, I think that these younger generations certainly are more mentally non-dualistic. I mean, the nature of the education, the just the sheer explosion of silent science, the communication systems teach us about the interconnectedness of everything. And I think this is as understood as a middle concept, as a basic construct, in a way that the older generations that are much more individualistic never quite access. So in that sense, it's quite true. But I think running against this has been the fact that for many of the young, they're products of entitlement, that parents have been so careful to be conscientious parents that there has been a feeding from the start of the child as special. Trigger alarms, when you have, you know, essentially there has been a pampering of the ego self, of the hypertrophied ego, as some people call it, which creates a very anomalous situation, because you have a cosmic sense of wanting to yearn and be a part. And yet the more the ego gets pampered, the more it gets separated out, the more you think that your identity lies in what you think, what you feel, what you accomplish, the more vulnerable you are to fear and urgency. And the new generations have had at least in the West, have had a kind of rug pulled out from under them that never happened before, with a massive disintegration of the religious culture, certainly in the West. There are more kids nowadays who have never been inside a church than who have been inside one. So we lack a container that ascends and transmits common values of what it means to be a human being. And so in the sense, the maximization of your own introspection is seen as the highest thing. And that's not a strong enough inner being fiber to stand up against the atrocities that we're gonna face, you know, and Ukraine is only the beginning of it. That we have to toughen up and we have to develop a way of dissolving ego barricades, gated communities, without the usual tools that people have relied on for, you know, five millennia to go about this. So it's a quandary that I take. You know, I'm stunned by both the generosity and the terrifying entitlement of the younger people I work with.
Cynthia, we are coming slowly to the end of our beautiful conversation here. And I think we should end on a positive note, since you have spread so many good words in the last few minutes and the last few hour even. And my question, and I think this goes back to the hope that our audience is, you know, waiting for, yearning for. So what could be the what contribution would you deem to be the most precious, to be the most sustainable ones for a world which is going to change massively over the course of the next few years, and is already changes are ramping up very dramatically. It's like a tipping point, the inflection point we already passed. So I was wondering whether you could end on a positive note and what could be our contribution today for a sustainable world.
Well, I think it begins, first of all, as I say, in working, in facing yourself, and in facing yourself with honesty, but also with gentleness. That everybody here is unique, and it has a common thread, and that we are all having our wonderful chance to be a part of this great, precious manifestation of divine belonging and playfulness and creativity. And to honor the freshness of that, and to just try to see it, not as a mental game, but to honor just everything yearning to pulse into being. And by whatever roots, as we can work to actually see and directly feel and sense the sacred interconnectedness of everything, I think it will help us to live more gently as we move out. I would say watch all urgency, insistence, and stridency in you. And even though we're coming to, you know, we stand in urgent times, and you know that there's a lot of good journalists making a lot of good money, you know, blaring things that terrorize us. We do our part. We're going to do our part. We will do the best we can to move our planet forward. But to try and do it not with a sense of, oh my God, if we don't do this, we're all going to die, but with a sense of, hey, we're human beings. We are all going to die. Let's just always bear in our hearts and in our eyes the face of what it looks like to be a human being, and to share that with others, both personally and collectively, in every movement, so that we move gently. And I think that if gentleness could be the touchstone for this Pentecostal experiment season, we will be bringing the world a great reservoir of something healing that it needs.
Oh, amen, Cynthia. Thanks so much for these precious words. They will mean a lot to many people just listening. I'm very sure about this.
Yeah. Well, thank you for a high quality interview. I hope that we haven't lost all our audience. But, But really wonderful stuff to talk about. So thank you both.
Thank you also from my side, Cynthia, with this gentleness that ends our interview. And we'll pass it on to our audience. And I'm very sure that it gives new perspectives on the situation we are living in, but also on the greater cosmical view of things, to be part of a pixel, as you told it at the beginning of your story, pixel of a huge picture. Yeah. So thank you very much, Cynthia.
Thank you, and we will see you at the airings of this during that week.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. All right.
Thanks so much.
I will bid you farewell then.